All right, so we all know that the LHC is about to turn the world upside down. At least our world upside down. And I think many of us have been anticipating it with great eagerness for many years. But like all really dramatic events, what you do about it isn't clear in its anticipation. Something that I've felt for a number of years is that since it's so close, the time for speculating for what we might see is rapidly coming to an end, and if not, has come to an end. And clearly, some of the most important issues to confront right away are the age-old problems that have been there for a long time, understanding QCD, backgrounds, very thorny, difficult problems that people have worked with for a long time, made a lot of progress on, and certainly something I've been spending some time doing is just catching up with what everyone has said and learned about the subject and thinking if there's anything new that can be added to it. I have nothing to say along those lines, but it's something I'm very interested in. And I think it's great that there are some talks at this meeting yesterday. I guess Christian talked about things like this, and Zvi is going to talk about things like this in the talk after mine. Something else which is clearly important, and a lot of people have been doing, is thinking about all the different possible handles we can get on really detailed and important properties of the new physics once we have lots of data, once we're dealing with hundreds of inverse of Gunther Barn of data. And that's also very important and I think very interesting. But it's very hard to not pay attention to the fact that very, very soon we're going to have order 100 inverse picobarn or over an inverse femtobarn of data, and we're going to have to try to deal with the very, very zeroth order, very, very zeroth order issues. So, at least in my own mind, preparing for dealing with the to do and dealing with the zeroth order issues, well, you know, it's not clear what'll be useful. Ahead of time, but the idea of playing with data challenges is one that I found very appealing, because that's at least an aspect of the problem which is not very actively studied, what you do when you're not trying to get the predictions of some set of models, but you're confronted with a bunch of data and you're trying to go back and figure out what the underlying theory is. So we had some very fun learning experiences with this, with the LHC Olympics. But a very standard complaint, one of the standard complaints about this exercise was that, you know, we played with views of inverse of femtobarn. We didn't know the underlying theory, but we could play with the data, and we could, with the pseudo data, and make plots, any plots we wanted, and that was very helpful for figuring out what was going on. Whereas what we're actually going to deal with ultimately is a bunch of plots presented by experimentalists in the summer conferences of 2009. And just from those plots, we have to start figuring out what's going on. So I decided to do a little exercise where we would just try something like that. Okay? Just try something like some model simulated. So Lian Talwang and I came up with a model. We simulated it and just made 20 plots and a bunch of counts. And gave it to our local colleagues who started playing with it, just to get an idea. Okay, so there's absolutely. I want to talk about that a little today, but I just want to stress something that there's absolutely nothing fundamentally new in anything that I'm saying. In fact, the point is that with data, it's the very simple techniques that have been known for a long time, that experts have moved beyond because they've known about them for a long time. But it's these very simple things that are going to be important. And using these simple things are going to be crucial to getting the zeroth order picture. Once we have the zeroth order picture, you know, as physicists, we're very good at doing Taylor expansions. But we have to make sure that you're in the right basin of attraction. And I think what I want to show you today is how the absolute simplest things you've all heard of you can actually use on 10 plots and a bunch of counts to get a pretty good zeroth order picture of what was going on. And none of this was done, this wasn't done, this is a couple of our postdocs, Patrick Mead and David Chi, worked on this for 2 afternoons So there's a lot more that could be done with it. It wasn't a particularly high priority for anyone, but still, they did a pretty good job, and I want to show you how it works. But actually, if I can spend just maybe 5 minutes, I just want to, that this is known probably for the majority of people in this audience, but because it's so simple, I want to spend just a little bit of time reminding you what these very simple, basic techniques are, and where they come from, because many of these things are things you can really understand analytically. So I just want to go through that for those of you who perhaps aren't familiar with it. Let's just get some scales to start with. So a typical strong interaction cross section for hard things at a TEV is around alpha F squared over a TEV squared, which is around 10 to the minus 36 centimeters squared, which is about a picobar. So those are the sorts of cross sections that we think about at the LHC. If the luminosity is between 10 to the 33 and 34, 1 over centimeter squared per second, so that this kind of cross section corresponds to rates which are 1 a second to 1 a minute, you know, a decent clip. Of course, the problem, the big problem is that the total cross section is the size of the proton. Is a millibar. This would give us 10 to the 9 events per second. PT bar is around 10 to the 3 picobar. This would give us 10 events a second. The W is around 10 to the 5 picobar, give us 1,000 a second. And psi bosons are around 100 picobar and give us an event a second. So all of these things dwarf the few per minute that we're after, and so that's why we have to figure out how to suppress these things by factors of 100,000 to 8,000. Okay, but we're after these picobar level cross sections. But the kinematics at any hadron collider make things counterintuitive relative to what you expect just from drawing Feynman diagrams, because we have the underlying partons colliding with each other that carry some momentum fraction xa and xb of the underlying protons. If I use light cone variables, let's imagine we're talking about the production of a pair of particles, 1 and 2, and then I can label the momentum of the outgoing particles in these light cone coordinates by their transverse energies, Ej, and the rapidities, Y, and their transverse momentum. And the parton model tells us what to expect for the cross-section, the product . So this is just the PDFs, the actual amplitude, and the Lorentz invariant phase space factor. And we can actually conveniently rewrite this in terms of the average rapidity. So that's the average boost of the Y of the 1-2 system. The invariant mass of the 1-2 system, these are all observables, and the PT for either 1 or 2, there's a Jacobian factor. I'm assuming the masses are the same, so there's a Jacobian factor when you do that. Okay, and where these x's in the limit where the masses are the same are just root s e to the y and root s e to the minus 4. And I'm working in units where the center of mass energy is 1. Okay, I'm writing this down because while this is the naive expectation, the PDFs are of course very important. And what they on a log-log scale, the PDF for up and down quarks looks something like this. For gluons, looks something like this. And the point is that when we get to sufficiently small x, all the PDFs of the quarks are the same, and they're completely determined by they're completely determined by color, by the color quantum numbers, because we lose all memory of what was originally in the proton. Things just continue to split and fragment. The reason there's a bump here for U and D is the only remnant of the fact that the proton is made of up quarks and down quarks. But the important point, for the purposes of the little estimates that I'm going to make, is that when x gets smaller than around 0.1, all these PDFs are pretty well approximated by a power. They all have the form of some, they look linear on a log-log plot. And that leads to a whole variety of simple rules for the scaling of cross-sections with the mass of particles that you make and the center of mass energy. So if I go back to this expression, for instance, you can see that let's say I'm talking about just the production of something as a resonance, just as a single particle that then decays to these 1 and 2, you can see that the only place where y bar appears here is in x. And the fact that it's sufficiently small x, there is a power, means that the y bar actually cancels in the product between FA and FB. And that means that the average rapidity distribution for a particle that you make on shell is pretty flat. It's pretty flat, and and it goes out to some y bar, which is just given by let's around 0.1 times the center of mass energy. Okay. Something else that you can see from this formula, if I now integrate over, if I don't care about what the overall boost is, and I only look at how things depend on the transverse momentum, something else that I can see, again, if I'm just talking about producing a resonance, is that d sigma turns into, just from the pieces that are left, comes from that Jacobian factor. And I'm left with what we'll call a parton luminosity. So this rho is nothing other than the integral over y bar of that FA of root s e to the y FB of root s e to the minus y bar. And precisely the same power behavior of the PDFs at small x turns into an approximate power behavior for the parton luminosity that scales like 1 over s squared. The rho of s goes like 1 over s squared, or like 1 over energy to the fourth. Okay? Very roughly. Actually, what that means, it's a little different for gluons than UU bar and DD bar because of the PDFs, those slopes are a little bit different. And in fact, we get this rule that the total production cross-section for a particle of mass m, which is which is 1 over m squared times this rho ab of m squared, this goes like 1 over m to the 6th for something that's initiated by glue, and 1 over m to the 5.3 for something that's initiated from UU bar or DD bar. So some of these are some of the very well-known rules, but they explain why it is that when we talk about the production of new particles, the cross-sections that we talk about at the LHC are such enormous ranges. Even though we're only talking about a factor of 10 in energy, those powers are pretty high. Okay, that was for producing a resonance. And if you're talking about producing, if you're talking about pair producing some particle of mass m, then if we're pair producing a particle of mass m, d sigma is, again, the d of the s over m squared, d squared of the pt over m. There's the same Jacobian factor again. The amplitude of normalized everything relative to the mass. There's again this parton luminosity. And once again, it's very important that this dies as this high power of s, because it means that the production cross-section is dominated, because this is dying as you go to large s, it's dominated by what's going on in your threshold. Okay? So the production of new particles at the LHC is dominated at threshold. No matter what the energy is, if you have a million TeV collider and you're making top quarks, dominantly the top quarks are made at rest. In fact, yeah, so I'm writing down a formula for the mean PT. Okay. So in fact, very roughly, the mean PT squared over m squared is around is a third for something initiated by gluons, and a half for something initiated by UU bar and dV bar. So this quantifies, but it's independent of m, at least over the ranges for which this PDF is well approximated by the power, which is true at the LHC. Okay? So this is the typical boost that they come out with. It's independent of the mass of the particle. And so this means that there's some effective s, which is not 4m squared. It's a little bigger than 4m squared, but it's around 5m squared if it's initiated by glue, and 6m squared if it's initiated by UU bar and dD bar. Okay. So things are basically made at threshold with these average PTs. And this physics leads to the huge qualitative difference between a hadron collider and a linear collider. At a linear collider, the cross-sections for making new particles goes like alpha squared over the center of mass energy squared, period. No, it's just an underlying point-like process. However, at a hadron collider, that's wrong, because it's dominated by near threshold. As you go to higher and higher energy, that means lower and lower x, and so you're going further and further up the power of the PDF. And instead, what you get is a sigma that goes like the same 1 over energy squared factor, but it has something that knows about that roughly six powers in the PDFs. In fact, this gives you something that goes roughly like e center of mass energy to the fourth for something that's initiated by gluons, and to the 3.3 for something that's initiated by UU bar or dV bar.
Okay. Yeah,
a lepton collider, e plus c minus. So the cross sections grow. Okay, so that's why hadron colliders are so wonderful. It also tells us, as we go from 14 TeV to 10 TeV this year, how much we're losing. We're losing roughly by this factor of 14 divided by 10 to the sixth, or 14 divided by 10, to the fourth, or 14 divided by 10 to the 3.3. So it's about a factor of 5 to 10 that we lose in the cross section. Okay. And all of this, and these big powers here, reflecting the homogeneity of the PDFs, also explain, as I mentioned before, if you look at the SUSY cross-sections, the SUSY cross-sections vary by around 6 orders of magnitude between 100 GeV and 1 TeV. And these are for strongly interacting, weakly interacting. There's, roughly speaking, this is for direct production, there's roughly speaking a factor of 1,000 between these guys. And that factor of 1,000 partially reflects an n color alpha s over alpha weak squared factor, which accounts for about a factor of 30 of this, partially reflects the fact that these guys can be triggered off the gluon PDFs that are bigger, which gives you another factor of 5. And anyway, this is very roughly the kind of scaling that we're talking about. Okay. Very good. So much for a production. These are the rules of thumb to remember for a production. And for decays, once we've made some new particles, well, if a new particle decays into two guys, and we see both B and C, then we just plot, we measure the invariant mass spectrum of B and C. We'll see a peak at the location of the mass of A. That's the trivial case where there's a resonance, and you can see it. The more interesting case where A goes to B, C, and D, where we lose D through some intermediate I, this depends on whether I is on shell or off shell. And if I is off shell, so you don't see this, there's clearly a maximum possible value for the invariant mass of BC, which is just the difference between the A and D masses squared. And so that's just a kinematic endpoint where there's no more phase space. That's if I is off shell. But if I is on shell, there's an extra constraint that it has to be on shell. And therefore, you never get to get here. Instead, there's an edge in the phase space. And when you work out the kinematics, the edge is at this location, square root of ma squared minus mi squared, mi squared minus mb squared over mi squared. So if you know something about the masses of D and A, you learn something about I, or vice versa. Okay, so that's it. These are all the, I think, simple things that are needed to start understanding or to start trying to decipher what is going on with a very little bit of data. All right, so now let me move to the example. So I don't know if any of you guys looked at any of these plots, but it was up on the wiki of the conference. Now, of course, very, very big caveats. This was done with this is signal only. It was a model that we came up with not to be easy or hard, but just what seemed like a totally reasonable model. And it was simulated with 100 inverse picobarn at 14 TeV, because this exercise was done in February, when that's what we would thought we would have by the end of the year. But again, the point here is just to see what you would do if you actually had the signal, if we had these plots that were claimed excesses that we're seeing. This theory is actually so simple, I think anybody could figure it out, but I just want to walk through, have some fun, and see how it would be done. Okay. So there were, we don't really know that there are 850 events, but there were 439 events that were seen. And anyway, we'll come back to some of these things later, but there's almost all the events have leptons. If you just add up all the leptons, it's about the total number of events. There's jets and leptons. In fact, there are bees everywhere. Just a second. Yeah, here are the bee jack counts at the bottom here. Is there a pointer? Okay. So in fact, there are a ton of bees. Given the efficiencies, basically all the events have bees in them. There are, remember, 439 events, and given the efficiencies for seeing bees, that almost all the events have bees in them. If you look at the B-jet lepton counts, there also seems to be some correlation with having bees and leptons that would argue that we might also have top quarks around, but we'll come back to justifying that a little bit later. All right, now, so we start off looking at the most obvious things that everyone looks at. You take the effective mass of everything in these events, so that's just the sum of the magnitude PT of everything, or you look at the invariant mass of everything, and both of these plots have a clear feature up here, at 1400 to 1600 GeV. And maybe there's a little feature down here, okay, at 300 to 400 GeV, that's there in both of them. It's a little iffy here, but we'll come back to justifying why there's probably something there in a second. Okay, but this is why I went through the first part. The fact that things are dominantly made at threshold allows us to nicely interpret the position of some of these peaks as being closely related to the masses of the particles. We couldn't do that if they're coming out really boosted. The fact that basically things are being made on threshold allows us to correlate these things with the masses of underlying particles rather nicely. And given that this is so heavy, if we think, oh, there's no evidence for any resonances anywhere, so we're thinking about pair production. And so this is consistent with pair producing some particle whose mass is around half of this scale, or at least the mass difference between, I haven't told you there's missing energy yet, but there's mass difference between the top and the bottom of the spectrum is around that. And given that that mass is so high, the only way you would get any rate like this is if it was colored. So we assume it's a colored particle, and we'll further just assume that it's supersymmetry. Okay? No, we don't know that. We don't know that. In fact, you know, I didn't solve this. As you'll see, what these guys did is made a whole variety of guesses. There's loopholes to every argument. What can I tell you? They got the right answer. So, nothing. Let's just begin. There is something, which is that there's a fair number of 4B events. Okay. With efficiencies, that's actually very likely all the events are 4B events. Given that there's 4 jets in every event, if you think it's something colored and you're thinking supersymmetry, then it's a gluino and not a squark decay, because the gluinos give you 2 jets on each side, and squarks will give you 1. Okay. These guys down here are consistent with thinking that there's something electroweak being produced with around that mass. Again, it couldn't be colored because the rate would be way bigger. So we seem to have something up here at 750, which is strong, something down here whose mass is probably in the neighborhood of 150, which is weak. Okay. There is missing energy. There's evidence for missing energy, so that makes us think that there is some neutral particle which is escaping the detector. And we can actually get a handle on what the mass of that particle is. We can get a handle on the mass of that particle by looking at the PT of the hardest jet. See, that we're saying that there are particles here whose mass is in the neighborhood of 700, 750 GeV. Again, things don't come out particularly boosted. Okay? So in order to get this hard PT tail going out a fair distance, there's no way that the bottom of the spectrum is at 300 GeV. Okay? Because then that wouldn't give enough phase space for that to happen. So this argues that the bottom of the spectrum is relatively light. Okay, let's put the bottom of the spectrum at around, for fun, around 100 GeV. That would be roughly consistent with everything. Okay? Actually, if we're thinking about supersymmetry, that also immediately tells us, or strongly suggests, that that the LSP is Beano-like. If the LSP had some SU2 cross E1 quantum numbers, then the rate for that bump down there would be a lot bigger. And so we would get a much bigger feature down there. The fact that that feature down there wasn't so big argues that it's Beano-like. Okay, so at this point we have a guess. Oh shoot. At this point we have a guess that we're pair-producing gluinos, and that the gluinos are somehow decaying to 2Bs and something. And because almost all the events have leptons in them too, we must be getting leptons from the decay of these guys somehow. They go to leptons somehow. Okay, so we're getting leptons from here. That's, of course, quite consistent with this guy not being the Beano, but being the second neutralino, being the Weino, let's say. All right. Now, let me also show you this plot. Now, once we have this picture that the gluino is going to a BB, we can try to see if that's happening through something that's on-shell or off-shell. And, you know, part of the point of this whole business is controlling combinatorial backgrounds. How do you know, not backgrounds, just combinatorial errors. How do you know you're pairing the right things up with what, see whether there's an edge or not. But you just go ahead and do it, okay? You look at something that you're sure involves hard things. You look at the invariant mass of the hardest 2B jets. And in this plot, you see something that looks like a pretty nice edge, right, at around here, okay? That seems to argue that there is something that's also going on shell. So in this decay, there's something that's going on shell in the middle, And so the natural guess is that there's a spottum down there. Okay? So it seems like there is a spottum that's going something like that. Yeah? Yes. I don't remember. Well, I can tell you right after the talk. All right. Now let's see if we can get a handle on what the mass of that intermediate particle is. We could get a handle on it if we had a handle on what the mass of the object that it's decaying to is. And actually, just in general, let's go see if we can learn about these objects in any other way. And of course, the hint is that we seem to be directly electroreproducing something too. In fact, you can see that just by going back to the counts. There seems to be a fair number of trilepton and dileptron events with few jets. Okay? So that seems to be associated with the direct electroreproduction. Just in order to get that rate to be reasonable, you can't put these guys to be too heavy either. The mass of these guys can't be too much heavier than around 200 GeV. Remember, we had the other argument that the bottom of the spectrum, I'll just take 5 more minutes if that's okay, that the bottom of the spectrum couldn't be much heavier than a few hundred GeV. So already we have a pretty narrow window where the WiNOs, the charginos and second neutralinos are around 200 GeV, the bottom of the spectrum is around 100 GeV. And furthermore, from the fact that we have trileptons, we know that those leptons aren't coming, all of them aren't coming from W's and Z's. Okay, we're getting some from sleptons going on shell. So in between this charginos, the WiNO state and the BeNO state, there's an on-shell slepton state too. So at this point, we have a guess. At this point, we have a guess for the top of the spectrum, WiNO up here, spottums down here, WiNO here, BeNO here, a slepton in the middle. So let's say 200, 100, 750. And once we put that at 200, from that BB edge, we get a guess for where this is, around 650. From the formula. Okay. All right, very good. Now, given that there are sleptons there, you might look for an edge in the decay of chi 2 to chi 1. Now we can look at the dilepton invariant mass plots. Okay, and this is tricky. Okay, you look at this dilepton invariant mass plot, there's two things that might look like edges. Is that an edge? Or is that an edge? It's there in that plot, and if both of those features are there in both plots, well, it's not obvious, but there seems to be something edgy going on, and so that's not inconsistent with the hypothesis that there are intermediate sleptons. In fact, it ends up being correct. That ends up being an edge. I don't think we exactly understand what that is yet. Maybe it's a disease, but we don't understand it. All right, but anyway, there are independent arguments that there are sleptons there. All right, finally, remember I told you from the B lepton counts there was evidence for tops. There's also an evidence that there are a lot of tops by looking at the invariant mass of all lepton and B pairs. One classic thing that gives you an edge is the decay of a top to bottom W on shell W to lepton neutrino. So there's an edge in the B lepton invariant mass, which is that when you stick in that formula, is at around 150 GeV. That's where it is. Okay? M top squared minus MW squared square root. Okay? Times MW squared minus zero. There's a nice edge right there. Okay? Now, so I'm telling you, this is caveat emptor all over the place, okay? But when you expect to see something somewhere and you see it, you think maybe that's also evidence that there are tops. Now, if there are tops, then given that we know that this middle thing, which everything has to go to get the leptons, Given that we also know that there are stops, that makes it very likely that this object here, there's a stop that goes along with it, and it's largely a left-handed third-generation object. Okay. Left-handed third-generation object that goes down to the Wino, that goes down, that cascades down to the bottom. Okay? Now, finally, we can get a handle on where the first two generation squarks are. Do we need the first two generation squarks? Well, there are some circumstantial arguments. One of them is these guys, I think, simulated three or four points. So they did a little bit of simulation in their two afternoons of work. Okay? But the simulation, it seemed hard to get the overall rate to work out just with the gluinos where they were. But there is another argument, which is that if we go back to that hardest jet PT plot, this is a little iffy, but you see, this really goes out to pretty high PTs. Okay? So the absolute hardest jets in this hardest PT plot are harder than you would expect coming out from boosted, coming out from the gluinos. Again, because of that, the boost factor wasn't that big. The boost factor is not enough to take you from the 700 GeV all the way up to this multi, to this much, much heavier guy. So that's circumstantial evidence that there's associated production as well. That while the dominant cross-section is being made from gluino pair production, there's associated production as well. And that tells you where to put the first few generations so that you get enough to both get the rate right and to explain this. And there was one other argument for it, which I now forget. Okay, but anyway, so finally then, this is the picture they came up with. First few generations up there, I forget where they put it, maybe 1,000. And the stop was there. And they had very little handle on where the other neutralinos were, and not much handle on where the right-handed third generation was. Okay? So in fact, they decoupled the right-handed third generation, and they didn't really know too much where the rest was, but then they did a little bit of simulation. Okay. Something very interesting was that I didn't show you our triggers, our trigger table, but there was direct lepton production in this theory, but because the spectrum was pretty squeezed, none of the leptons that came from that lepton decay actually passed via triggers. So you didn't see any of the leptons directly from the lepton production. Okay, very good. So that's what they did, and let me show you the answer. Oh, this is going to test my PowerPoint skills. But non-PowerPoint. Oops. Let's see. Okay. Oops, what the heck is going on? Sorry, guys. Okay. So this was their guess, and these were the answer for the underlying theory. Okay. So, as you see, they did a pretty good job. They certainly got all of the ordering was correct. Okay. The whole ordering of the spectrum was correct. The masses were pretty, but again, I mean, they didn't scan or do anything. This was a very, very zeroth order thing. The main things that they screwed up were that they, as I said, decoupled the right-handed third-generation squarks, and that was the wrong answer. Okay, but I don't really know how they would get the. And they put the Higgsinos where they were just because it helped with the rates a little bit. But again, there was very little handle on that. So some things, I think, a lot of the gross features were gotten correctly, even with this very little data, and some of the things are missing. But all in all, I certainly learned a lot from this exercise, and I enjoyed it. Now, as I said, Leon Tao and I made this model just because we thought it was a reasonable model, not to make it easy or hard. It turned out to be very easy. Some of our other friends have made examples for us that I just want to very quickly show you. Where the heck are they? Yes. So Jesse Thaler made an example for us. This was with 500 inverse picobarn. There's an awful lot of structure in this example. Again, he just released a bunch of plots and the counts. I'm not showing you the counts, but anyway, you're not going to learn anything from it anyway. I just want to show you there's all sorts of structure in this theory. There are these multiple bumps. There's another multiple bump there. There's some Z's there. Okay. There's all kinds of structure in this model, 500 inverse picobarn. We spent one afternoon looking at it, and we definitely didn't figure out in one afternoon. This seems like a quite hard example. OK, least in our first pass through it, it doesn't seem remotely as easy as the ones that we looked at. Jesse claims that if we understood what was going on in this theory, there would be a single plot we would ask him to make for us. Okay. And finally, Natalia Toro and Philip Schuster made another example. Where the heck is that one? Oh, yeah, sorry. I don't know what I have to do for that. Okay. And this was, before I go to that, let me go back. Philip sent me an email. See, these guys are with the following rules. So they want to make this even more realistic. So what they did is they generate 100 inverse picobarnum signal, pass it through their detector, which is not the same as the detector that we know. So they screwed around with the parameters. They tweaked them by 5 to 20%. They didn't tell us how. They generated the signal in ways that had nothing to do necessarily with Pythia or anything else that we're familiar with. They only released plots like two separate sets of experimentalists might, looking at two different signal regions. One set that had multi-jet plus MET cuts, the other set, and a lepton veto, the other set that had a dilepton requirement. So it's two completely different kinds of signal region. And this was the fun thing. They told us they'd be very happy to make further plots for us to look at, but only if we could convince them that the backgrounds could be controlled reasonably for that region, and that we would have to negotiate with them. And I've negotiated with these guys, and they're tough customers. So. Okay, and they also said that since they changed the detector, they'd be happy to send us a standard model signal. Now, this one we also started looking at, and this one is a nightmare, as far as I can tell. Let me just show you some of the plots. Completely featureless plots. Okay? I mean, nothing. Other than that there is some signal, I can't see an edge or an endpoint or nothing in this example. So I have no idea what it is. But I think this is another exercise that I hope to start looking at. And we'll anyone who's interested in looking at these things is more than welcome to contact us. But anyway, what I hope to have shown you, these are really, they're games, okay? They're games, they're fun. I think for me, it's a little bit like the LHC is the most complicated experiment in history, and it's, you know, airplanes are very complicated objects, and you don't just fly a plane. You get in a flight simulator for a while, and it's not quite realistic, but you get an idea of what it's like. And I think these exercises serve that purpose. They just give you some idea of what it's like. Of course, it's not exactly like what it really is like. It can be off from it by 45 degrees, or by 60 degrees, or by 80 degrees. But I don't think it's off by 90 degrees. The other thing which was interesting about this for me, as I said, is the fact that it is possible, at least in some examples, to really go far with very little data and just a bunch of plots. Okay? So it really is conceivable that, that example is trivially figure-outable by anybody. Okay? So it's, if something like that's going on in nature, it's really conceivable, and a year from now we'll be arguing about exactly where the lepton is and where the rest of the spectrum is. It could be really that quick. All right, thank you very much.
Question, comments?
You never mentioned using like sign dileptons.
No. There's an awful lot more you could actually do, but
right. Would that have been equal in this example?
There were the sort of equal amounts of each. Yes. So there was both sets of things going on. So. Yeah, but no, there were. There were the counts, but it wasn't the... Yeah, there are same-sign dileptons. I mean, there's many more things that one can do, even at this level. This was a very, 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 very zero sort of stuff. Matt?
So, I have to say, anyway, I'm really not sure why you're playing these games at this point in this way for 100 inverse picobarns. There's sort of two or three things which are I think, sort of deeply misleading. One of them is that the experimental resolutions at 100 inverse picobarns are going to be nowhere near good enough for some of these plots.
Well,
the backgrounds are going to be actually in the plots. They're not going to show us background
in the
plots. And if it's this easy, Frank and Ian, you know, are going to figure it all out. They knew this. You know, they invented a lot of these techniques.
We
will never see, if it's this easy, we'll never even see the plots. We'll just see the answer, essentially. And we'll see the plots.
I agree.
You know,
I agree.
Situation we're going to be faced with. What we're actually going to be faced with, presumably, is a much messier situation. We have to really start preparing for that because we only have a few months to do that left now.
This is why I gave, I went through one example which was very easy, and I completely agree. In this example, actually, in this example, all this sort of exercise teaches you is, you know, what we'll be sitting in the audience as they convince us what's going on and what we'll nod our head to. And we say, yes, 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 it all makes sense. At this level, I don't care who does what, okay? I just want to see, I even though the sociology is very important, I don't care about it. At zeroth order. I just want to see, it's really, you know, just a very simple existence proof of something which could be going on, a perfectly reasonable theory, where it's not impossible to figure out what it is with a little bit of data, and it's all the most standard techniques that we've known for 15 years, and people have moved beyond them and do much more fancy things. But at the beginning, getting to the zeroth order stuff, and this example is not that hard. The other examples, I have no idea.
I mean, even in this example, if you had weakened the B tagging and removed the B resolution, then in fact the order in which things would be done would be quite different.
I agree.
So,
I agree. I completely agree. I think that would be too much. You would lose a factor of 10 in the entire signal.
Besides, the chance of them getting 100 speaker barns at 10 TV is pretty low.
That's what we'll have by the end of this year. No. What's kind of bad about this exercise is that it goes, by the end of 2009, we'll have a factor of 10 more data. We'll have an inverse femtobarn.
Right, and they'll all be coming out in a flood when they have to calibrate it.
Right.
And not before.
No, I mean, so this is, look, as Yogi Berra said, prediction is always hard, especially when it's about the future. And so this is not, you know, I think all of these exercises have this flavor problem to them. You can try to make them more realistic, less realistic, but what realistic means is still in our eyes, and what's actually happening could still be completely different than everything we anticipate. That was really not the spirit of this. The spirit of this was much more about how it's actually possible, if the signal is visible and it's not that hard to beat down the background, which is true in this case, by the way, that these very simple things anyone can understand can already get us to this kind of picture. In this example, and in the other examples, it looks very hard to me. I think I would be very interested in seeing how, especially Italian Phillips example, would work, because that seems completely opaque to me. I have no idea how to get started.
Since you've got a good estimate of the Gluino mass and the production cross-section, you've determined that the spin of the Gluino is a half.
Whatever.
And
yeah.
Confirmed its supersymmetry as well.
Okay. Great.
So you've got no problem with using supersymmetry there. And we're all set on...
Whether or not we do it, everyone else will anyway.
More questions? Okay. Yes. Here.
So you pointed out a lot of features in these plots that were real.
Oh, sorry, there's another question. Yes, sir. Yes.
There's one feature that confused me, which might not be a real feature at all, but in the dileptron mass plot, it sort of looks like there's a linearly vanishing endpoint at around 250.
Oh, really?
And it's probably nothing, but somehow you have this nice story where you pointed out all the right features, but there are other features you can see if you look. So,
as everyone knows who's ever played with any of these things, indeed. You're talking about that guy?
It's more clear in the opposite sign.
Which one?
Let's see. Opposite sign in all events, yeah.
This one?
No, that's just the dilapidum.
Oh, there.
So in that and in the one that's same flavor opposite sign.
Yeah, I don't know what that is. I don't know if it's real. I don't know what that is in I don't know what
I think
that
it's
is
nothing,
in this
but,
yeah.
But it confused me a lot. So.
I mean, I should say, neither Leontau and I attempted to solve this theory. So I'm presenting for you the chain of arguments that Patrick and David went through, and they also didn't devote much time to it. So there's a lot more that could be done.
Okay, if there are no more questions, let's thank Nim again. We have coffee break now. We come back at 11. Thank you.